Welcome to How to Stop Climate Change. I'm your host, David Butler, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Russell, and my producer and daughter, Keaton Butler.
Our guest today is R.L. Miller, an influential political activist who founded Climate Hawks Vote, an organization that endorses and supports Democratic candidates who are serious about developing effective climate policies. She has been a leading advocate for a presidential climate debate and getting Democratic candidates to pledge that they won't take fossil fuel money. And she was just elected to the Democratic National Committee.
Thanks for joining us, RL.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So I think that your career is very interesting, and I wonder if you could give us a brief synopsis of it, and then we'll dive into it in more detail a little later in the show.
So I am a mom, first off. I simply want to leave the world for my children at least as good as the world that I found. And that is what has compelled me to speak out on climate change. I got into this as a second career. I started off as a lawyer, but equally importantly, as a mom. For a long time, I was a part-time volunteer with my children. I drove them to field trips. I dressed up as Clifford, the big red dog, when they needed somebody at the books fair that they were doing. I drove my kids to the hockey rink when they got into hockey, when they got into jazz band. I ran the bake sales at the back of the high school gym and did all the mom things that one would do. Much as Trump has gotten a lot of moms off the sidelines and into politics, my own entree was Sarah Palin, who in her biography was very similar to me. About the same age, community organizer, hockey mom, absolutely unqualified to be vice president of the United States. And I began discovering politics. And I also looked into climate change because I was a little girl who wanted to save the rainforest without really knowing where it was or why it should be saved, and save the tiger because they were like a cool looking animal, never mind the biodiversity stuff. And the more I've read about climate change, the more alarmed I got. I live in Southern California, and we used to have a fairly well-defined wildfire season that would go from September 1st to roughly the first rains of November. And suddenly I was seeing wildfires in May when our hills were supposed to be lush and blooming. I would see wildfires in January because there was no winter rains. And the ultimate tipping point for me was in 2018 when the fires came within 500 feet of my home. I am now a Woolsey fire survivor. And so when I say that climate change is right here, right now, I'm speaking from experience.
Yeah, that must be a very traumatic experience to survive a wildfire and escape.
Yes, I had PTSD or something like it for a month afterwards, and I don't even think I realized it. But inside, I was a wreck.
Yeah, nobody would blame you for that. Most of us can't possibly imagine what that would be like.
It was terrifying. I watched my children's memories burn down on national television. I knew what was happening early enough that I got my mom out early before the 3 a.m. sheriff knock on the door. I was settled in at my boyfriend's house and watching my children's soccer fields, their preschools, the places where we did birthday parties, the place where I got married. It was a beautiful stone cottage in the hillside, is now nothing more than a chimney.
From my side, looking in at that from a distance, I was watching that from across the other side of an ocean, and we're watching a feed of these incredible fires sweeping across those hills. We're getting, as you've described, there were people live tweeting and Facebook living what they were seeing from, I was about to say, an incredibly dangerous situation, but the amount of fatalities involved, it just speaks for itself and just how devastating it was. And all of this is happening down the west coast of the United States. And then on the east coast of the country, there are devastating floods, hurricanes blowing in, huge water damage happening on the other side. And I think that it's at a macro level for a lot of us. We looked at what was happening there in 2018 with all the coverage coming from the US, and we would look, you're never going to get a better example from the outside of how our climate is changing and how it's affecting our world.
It's a macro level. I can give you the statistics on how wildfires have gotten so much worse in California. At this point, for me, it's also a micro level. And one thing I really want to impress on people is how prevalent this has suddenly become in a way that we don't even notice, much as the virus has become so noticeable. You know, it's just sort of crept up until it's suddenly our new reality. I do something in California where if I'm speaking to an audience of Californians throughout the whole state, I ask, first off, anybody to stand if they're from Paradise, California. And nobody stands because nobody's from Paradise. It's just one little dot on a map. Then I ask people to stand if they've been affected by any of our wildfires. The Thomas Fire, the Mendocino Fire, the Yosemite Fires, the Cedar Fire down in San Diego. I mean, we got a list here. And about a third of the room stands up. And then I ask people to stand up simply if they know somebody who's been affected by all the wildfires. And every single person in the room stands up. Everybody knows somebody who's been affected. I could do the same thing in New Orleans. I could do the same thing in Iowa or Nebraska, asking about the floods. I could repeat this anywhere in the United States. And people talk about climate change like it's some sort of far off, abstract, 30 years in the future kind of thing. But no, that's not true. It is right here and right now. And that's why I decided to do something about it.
Well, I'm sorry that you had to suffer through that, but I'm happy that you did decide to do something about it, because I feel like you've made some significant dents, actually, and you're maybe poised to do a lot of good.
I hope so. In about 2014 or thereabouts, I got frustrated with green groups that were primarily educating people. That is to say, they would write extremely well-researched reports saying that we have a problem. And those reports would basically get round-filed because there was no political power behind them. And on the other hand, you have a Republican Party that is in flat-out denial and a Democratic Party that is not in denial, but is having a hard time juggling this thing that they think is far off and distant with a lot of other urgent things that are happening right now. Black Lives Matter. We need to address police brutality right now. Immigration matters. Kids are in cages at the border. We must address that right now. Those are just a couple of easy examples, but there are so many other things. So it was very easy for climate to take a back seat compared to all of those other crises demanding attention right now. So I founded a group called Climate Hawks Vote to build political power for the climate movement. In a nutshell, we try to endorse and elect candidates who will not just be common or garden variety Democrats, but instead be fierce on climate change and treat climate change as an urgent top priority. Separately, I was asked to get involved in local Democratic Party politics. In 2013, I challenged the sitting chair of the Environmental Caucus of the California Democratic Party, and I won. And so I became the chair of the caucus since 2013. I've had that title, which sounds really impressive, but honestly, it's not super. It doesn't actually convey a lot of power until I asked people to start pledging not to take fossil fuel money. And I'm very pleased to say that the No Fossil Fuel Money pledge was kicked off in my platform, in my caucus. I put words asking candidates to sign on a big foam core board to pledge not to take money from the oil, gas, and coal industries. And I told political people who'd come around the California Democratic Party wanting to speak to the Environmental Caucus that if they wanted to talk to my caucus, they had to sign that in full view of 300 activists. or if they wanted to continue to take oil money, they needed to just explain why.
Wow, that's pretty cool. What were kind of some of the initial reactions?
Oh, everybody loved it. A few people were hesitant. I've only had a couple of people, and they weren't very important, refuse to sign. But that became the No Fossil Fuel Money Coalition. And that pledge has been signed by the next president of the United States. And by that, I mean that we got that pledge signed during the primary by every single Democratic candidate. Almost all of them, well, all of them have dropped out, and Joe Biden is almost assuredly going to become our nominee, and he has signed that pledge. So that's how you make a difference.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And fossil fuel money is so poisonous. Maybe it's the biggest problem that we have with lack of action on climate.
I say that it is a dark tidal wave of oily money drowning our democracy.
Yeah. Well, we've talked on the show about the oil companies' campaigns to sow doubts about climate science, you know, in lots of different ways, in the public and in the press. And Drilled is a fascinating podcast all about that.
Yes.
But definitely that money that goes into campaigns is probably the most effective money that they spend if they want to try to put off action.
And it's so important that politicians not take that money. And so the No Fossil Fuel Money pledge has been obviously signed by presidential candidates, and that's awesome. But we want it to be signed by politicians at the start of their political career, when they're running for county supervisor, city council. We want them to think about what kind of politician they want to be, whether they think that all money is good or some money is better than others. And it's time to say no to the worst of the money. And that's one thing where I think that I have had a powerful influence at many levels of the party, making it politically toxic to take that money, except at the DNC.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful to have all the nominees sign the pledge, which means, as you say, the next president of the United States won't have had fossil fuel money as part of the process that got them there personally. But then it's worth asking, is that money still going into the DNC itself? And as I understood it, the DNC did actually pledge not to take any fossil fuel money at all and then changed their mind. Have I got that right? And if so, what did cause them to change their mind?
What caused them to change their mind was Tom Perez overruling Christine Pelosi and me. My friend Christine Pelosi is the daughter of Nancy Pelosi and is a powerful member of the DNC in her own right. And she's a reformer. And she wrote a resolution calling on the DNC to stop taking money from entities whose values conflict with the Democratic Party platform, which translated into, I think, private prisons and payday lenders. And they passed that. I went to Christine and I said, well, fossil fuel money is contrary to Democratic platform. So let's cross out the words payday lenders and private prisons and write in fossil fuel companies. She presented a resolution, got it passed through the DNC executive committee. Then 2 months later, Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, came out with a new resolution that undid her work, our work. And I was furious. She was furious. I remain furious about it. It was one of the places where I began to realize just how entrenched the DNC and how resistant to change and progress the DNC is.
And is that his, like, I'm trying to understand what Tom Perez's motivation could have been. I, like, from an outsider looking in, as you've described it, this is a win-win for everybody, at least everybody that isn't the fossil fuel lobby. It really aligns with the strategy of the party, with the philosophies and with the goals. Like, why would he undermine it? What was his reasoning for overturning the initiative?
Honestly, I can't even begin to tell you what his thought process was, because we did our best to explain to him that we are not trying to bar money coming in from Eddie Exxon, the guy who runs the gas station, or the guy who works in the oil field and is paid $15 an hour. What we're trying to do is ban money from Exxon's C-suite, the Rex Tillersons of the world. And they just didn't believe us. I don't know how else to put it. They just didn't want to hear from us. And it was extremely frustrating. So I cannot begin to tell you what was in his head.
Yeah, so that was a big battle. You fought hard for that as well.
Yeah. We did everything that we could do to get a democratically elected body to listen to us. We delivered 225,000 signatures to DNC headquarters. We wrote op-eds. We spoke up on Twitter. I know, because I'm more active in the Democratic Party than some of my climate activist friends, that Democrats speak in the language of resolutions. And I drafted a template resolution for Democrats to pass, asking their local DNC members to vote for a climate debate. And that resolution was passed at the Utah State Party, by Minneapolis, by county parties in Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Illinois. I can go on and on. And still, they didn't listen to us. I showed up at that DNC meeting furious, but refusing to believe that a democratically elected body would not listen to all the Sunrise kids in the hallways chanting, would not listen to reason. And wow, I was just amazed at what happened there. So I came out of that determined to run for DNC myself, to be a vote, to be a voice on the inside, to tell other DNC members that climate change is right here, right now, and it demands your immediate attention. And so I ran for DNC, and I am now an elected member of the DNC. My term will not start until after the Milwaukee convention ends, to be clear. I will not have a vote, but I certainly will have some influence between now and then.
So you won't be able to start any trouble until after this coming convention?
Oh, I think I'm capable of starting trouble before.
Yeah. Well, I find it even more difficult to understand why Tom Perez wouldn't have a climate change debate than to understand why he wouldn't ban fossil fuel money.
I can't tell you for sure. My theories, number one, I heard from on the inside that he saw it as a direct threat to his leadership, regardless of the content. He wanted to win the battle, just as a stubbornness kind of thing. I can also tell you, because I was in that room when it happened, that one of the resolutions committee members expressing serious opposition to a climate debate was Simone Sanders, who was also Joe Biden's spokesperson. This was being done to protect Joe Biden. That was another theory I heard. And the last theory I heard is that Perez still believes, as do many old school Democrats, that talking about climate change, a ban on fracking, may cause us to lose Pennsylvania. A ban on ICE cars, internal combustion engine cars, would cause us to lose Michigan, et cetera, which is ridiculous. It's old school thinking. That certainly could be one of the things going on in his head.
There's certainly the risk of losing a lot of states if you don't motivate younger voters and voters that are very interested in saving the climate.
There's so much more that could be said here. If I were to talk on why we're not going to lose Michigan and Pennsylvania over these overblown fears, I would devolve into a ball of white hot rage.
Yeah.
You might expect the Democratic National Committee to operate in a way that's, well, democratic. You might imagine members discussing issues in an open dialogue and building consensus as they decide how the party and its platform should evolve. But apparently it's not quite that simple.
One of the things I found out during the climate debate is that the DNC is, instead of being a democratically elected, transparent, and accountable body, instead is a black box. And I think that the fact that it is so secretive has led to some of the conspiracy theories and paranoia that has sprouted up. When you don't have any information at all, it's easy to invent information. So, for example, they don't give out the email addresses of DNC members to other DNC members, which is mind-boggling to me. All communication goes through the DNC, through this centralized clearinghouse, and is approved or not approved, I guess. I don't know if they actually censor email, but they certainly read every email.
That's really bizarre.
Yeah.
I never would have guessed that.
Yeah. Here's another one. Now, California elects 20 of our DNC members, and even our appointed DNC members are listed on our state party website. But other states, Democrats do not know who their DNC members are.
Huh.
Yeah. This isn't even whether they're elected or appointed. This is a matter of who are they?
Yeah. That's just crazy. I mean, it seems like, if nothing else, that's the worst way to get people involved in the party. Like,
absolutely.
You want to get people excited and engaged.
Yeah. And so one of the really basic things that we had a hard time doing for the climate debate was getting the names and contact information of all DNC members. And we did, because we're persistent and we had some ability to get a hold of some rosters maintained by the DNC. And then we had some researchers go and track down contact information for each of these people. But the fact that we had to go through all that is just crazy. I mean, one of the things I want on the DNC is a simple public-facing website that lists who the DNC members are, maybe has like a little picture of bio and one-line bio about each person and how to contact, you know, so it would be rlm@dnc.org, tomperez@dnc.org. So you at least have some ability to contact people. It's just crazy.
Yeah, it's creepy. It's
when you don't know who the DNC members are, it becomes much easier to invent, to attribute insane things to them.
Oh, I see what you mean. So if upper leadership wants to say, this is what the committee wants, it's easy to do that if the committee can't talk to each other.
Exactly. And that brings me to another point that enraged me when I found this out. All these DNC rules about the debates, and I mean not just that there would be no climate debate, but all the other rules that we watched play out during the last year on how you had to get X percent in Y polls in Z states to qualify for the next debate, those rules were never voted on by the DNC body as a whole. They were made up in Tom Perez's head.
Wow.
Right. And the DNC, as a body, should be voting on these things. Maybe they would have rubber stamped what Perez did, but at least they could go back to their people and say, yes, I voted for this rule. If you don't like it, hold me accountable.
Yeah. So for people that that didn't follow that very closely, what are some of the rules that you're referring to, and what were the impacts that they had?
It was the debate qualification rules that you had to get. It started off as 1% in these nationally recognized polls and $65,000 donations or some sort of thing like that from 20 states. And as they went forward, the bar slowly increased. So it was 2% in polls and $130,000 unique donors. And then it was 3% in the polls or place in the first contests or something like that. And the net result was that it ended up squeezing out the senators, the people of color, the women, people like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, while permitting the white male billionaires who could spend indefinitely to get those unique donors. So Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg were spending $14 on Facebook advertising to get $1 in a donation that they could consider as a qualifying donor or qualifying donation.
Oh, and Lord.
Yeah. And so it was not a good look for a body that is supposed to be a party of the people.
Yeah.
And I want to make the Democratic Party more a party of the people.
That sounds like a good idea. I'd like that.
It sounds reasonable.
I don't feel a very close relationship to the Democratic Party, honestly. I'm a registered Democrat, but I'm frustrated with performance on climate and a lot of things. And I think if you can build a movement to get some of these changes made, that sounds like a huge improvement.
And that's one thing I want to be working on. And at the same time, I want to talk about how climate people and environmentalists vote or don't vote. As I say, I started an organization by the name of Climate Hawks Vote, and we take that vote part very seriously. No, the Democratic Party isn't perfect. Yes, the Democratic Party needs a lot of improvement. But on the other hand, it is effectively the only game in town. And so what happens is that people who are not terribly enthused about it stay home. Let me give you three statistics right now. First off, according to Nathaniel Stinnett, who runs the Environmental Voter Project, and he has data to back this up, he calculates that somewhere between 10 and 15 million environmentalists, people who describe themselves as environmentalists, people who recycle diligently and watched Al Gore's movie 12 times over, don't vote. So 10 to 15 million people don't vote. Second statistic, friends of mine at a national longstanding green organization that you would recognize instantly, they've been around for 40 years, matched up 1 million people on their list randomly to the voter files and found out that of their 1 million people sample in 2016, 1/3 did not vote at all.
That's really horrible.
Third statistic. Donald Trump won by less than 100,000 votes.
Let's recap those statistics really quickly, because they're pretty disturbing. Number one, 10 to 15 million self-described environmentalists don't vote. Number two, 1 million members of a well-known green organization were sampled, and 300,000 of them didn't vote in 2016 at all. Number three, Donald Trump won by less than 100,000 votes, so we have nobody to blame but ourselves.
Among many other things, I am the co-leader of the U.S. Climate Action Network's Elections 2020 team. And what I do is I'm trying to talk to the environmental organizations on the importance of simply getting your people to register to vote. It sounds like such a basic thing. Get your people to register to vote and then get them to vote. But so many climate environmental groups have neglected it, other than maybe one brief mention of, you know, today is election day, you should show up and vote. It's so much more than that. We need to keep people engaged. And of course, we need to keep them engaged by making the Democratic Party better. And at the same time, if we do get them engaged, then the Democratic Party will be better.
Yeah.
Because it listens to the people, in theory. And so that's why I want to emphasize to your listeners that the single most important thing that you can do to stop climate change is to get involved in your party and get involved in your local civic life. I know it's hard. I know sometimes we don't have time to show up for all those town hall meetings and city council meetings where sometimes local land use decisions are made that have tremendous implications all the way down, but it's just so critical.
Yeah, that's a good message. And at least at a minimum, go vote. It's infuriating when people don't vote.
Yeah. And right now, we're watching this horrific virus play out. And so my organization, like many others, is pushing vote by mail very hard. People should not have to choose between saving their lives and saving their democracy.
No.
And the way that we do that is by voting by mail or voting from home or absentee voting, whatever it's called in your state. My son worked in upper Wisconsin, where he saw what I call the Wisconsin Walking Dead primary play out in real time. And it was frightening. And yeah. I'm very heartened by the fact that the people of Milwaukee showed up to wait in 5-hour lines to just to exercise their civic duty. I think that they were heroes, but at the same time, they shouldn't have had to go through that.
No, not at all.
Aurel, you did mention about the candidates all signing up to the No Fossil Fuel Pledge and the changes that are happening, positive and negative, within the DNC at the moment. As part of Biden's campaign, he's pulled together an environmental task force with, I think, about 8 seats, and AOC is part of that, along with John Kerry. Are you optimistic for that group? Is it a group you're able to communicate with, or are you hearing anything coming out of that group one way or the other, positively or negatively?
I am heartened by the fact that Biden put together what was basically a unity commission on climate. So there were people from the Bernie side and people from the Biden side. I am troubled by the fact that so far it's had 2 very non-public meetings. There are 3 different things going on with respect to the platform right now, and so far all of them are really opaque. The first is whatever is going on within the Biden camp, and I don't have any insights over there. All I can tell you for sure is that the platform usually ends up looking like the candidate's platform. I do hear rumors that Biden is going to be releasing a new and improved platform in the next few days or few weeks. I don't know anything about what's in it, but he and the DNC would in theory be getting together to work out a platform that would look a lot like what he wants. He has the ultimate say over it. The second thing is this, as I called it, Unity Biden-Bernie Commission, that has had a couple of meetings so far. My friend Varsh over at Sunrise has put out a short video saying that she's a little optimistic. Everything that they've done so far has been in secret. Third thing is that in San Francisco last year, at the same time as they voted down the DNC climate debate idea, they also voted up the existence of a brand new DNC Climate and Environmental Council. And I'm on the advisory committee to that council. And I know that the head of that council, who is a DNC member, is working up her own idea of a platform, and she wants to hold public hearings. And that is, I think, a truly laudable idea, because again, the Democratic Party is or should be a party of the people. And the best way to test whether Pennsylvania voters would get scared off by a ban on fracking is to go to Pennsylvania and, I guess, host a Zoom call these days instead of a public town hall. Yeah. But host a Zoom call with average Pennsylvania voters and ask them what they think. Go to Michigan and host a Zoom call among United Auto Workers folks and ask them what they think about a phase down of gasoline powered cars in favor of building electric cars, because we do have to replace our gasoline powered cars with EVs. Let's ask auto workers if that's going to turn them into raging Republicans, or if they're actually going to be excited about working on the cars of the future.
Yeah, it's not the end of the auto industry.
No, it's not.
It's an evolution.
Yeah. Speaking of somebody who owns an EV myself, it is more fun to drive than any other car I've ever owned in my life.
I bet. I would love to have one.
I can barely afford mine.
We'll be right back after this short break. In order to reverse climate change, we need to emit less and remove the rest. A few episodes ago, we spoke with Alden Donnelly from Nori, a company that is doing just that. Nori is a virtual marketplace for carbon removal retention credits. When you purchase a carbon removal credit, that represents 1 ton of carbon dioxide that has been removed from the atmosphere and put into the soil. Farmers can register their carbon removals on the Nori marketplace, and people just like you can pay for ownership of the carbon removed from the atmosphere, making it incredibly easy to participate in reversing climate change. If you want to learn more about offsetting some of your carbon footprint, visit nori.com. That's N-O-R-I.com.
So, RL, we talked a little bit about your career and how it evolved over time. Let's go into a little more detail on that and kind of talk about each step in your path and what you did to get to the point where you're having the impact that you are now.
Sure. And this was very much an evolution. First off, I began as a terrified public speaker. I showed up at one meeting where I was supposed to be running for like vice president of the local Democratic club. And I had a speech prepared and I practiced my speech and I did the other thing that I always do, which is bake a homemade pie. And I brought the pie, but I left the speech at home.
Oh, no.
And so I stood up and I said, vote for me. I brought the pie. But I found that you could get fairly far in Democratic Party politics by showing up, bringing homemade pie, being decent to other people. There's a certain amount of slogging through parliamentary stuff and Robert's rules of order and such like that, that I've never been very good at. And I just tune out and start playing on my phone. I shouldn't say that, but it is important to show up and get involved because that is the room where it happens. Let me give you one example of how I was able to get a real change accomplished. And again, this is not something that cannot be duplicated. This is something that anybody could do. Bill McKibben was doing a road trip on Do the Math back in, I believe it was 2012, talking about the importance of leaving fossil fuels in the ground. And his idea at that time, and still is very much an idea, was to divest. Now, I'm in California, where the California Public Employees Retirement System, CalPERS, I think I got the acronym right, and the University of California have enormous power through their accounts. And both of them were, at that point, heavily invested in fossil fuels. And so I came back from that and inspired to make change happen. And I took Bill's ideas and I wrote a resolution calling on CalPERS and the UC system to divest from fossil fuels. And I got that. It took me a couple of years of convincing Democrats that that was actually important. But I ultimately got that resolution passed through the California Democratic Party. It took, as I say, 2 years of being a bulldog about it and not giving up and showing up. And a lot of it was individual one-on-one conversations to persuade people. But ultimately, I got that passed through the platform. Then Kevin DeLeon picks up that idea and turns it into a bill calling on CalPERS to divest from coal. At that point, he wouldn't take on oil and gas, but just coal. And I worked that bill in the summer of 2015. I coached 350 volunteers as to how to meet with your local assembly member and tell them that this bill is incredibly important. And we got that bill passed, and we got that bill turned into a law. And so CalPERS has to divest from coal by basically this year. And separately, the UCs divested from fossil fuels last week.
That's really exciting.
Yeah.
And a very concrete step.
And that's how change happens. And it wasn't just me, especially with the UCs. That was a lot of student activism. That was a lot of alumni and faculty activism. I did my part within the Democratic Party. Other people have picked it up on the campuses and shown that, yes, one of the largest public university systems in the United States can do this and did this.
And that makes it so much easier for the next one.
Yeah. So let's talk about why Harvard and Yale won't divest, right?
Yeah.
I have no pull there, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But that's how change happens. It starts off sometimes just as a couple of snowflakes. Then it becomes an avalanche.
So once you kind of step up and start going to meetings, opportunities will present themselves. Is that what you're saying?
Right. And one thing that is hard for climate activists to understand is that, as I said before, that there's a lot of competing priorities for Democrats. And I've had to understand the importance of coalition building. And that means that when gun violence comes up or immigration comes up, I will be in the background choir helping along the solo singer. I just need to know that they will have my back when it is time to talk about climate. And that is part of the importance of coalition building. And I'm always looking for more ways to work with other people, to form alliances with the education people on why it's important to talk about climate. And at the same time, let's talk about the importance of not privatizing education. And so you find those different places where you can build coalitions. And that is hard sometimes for climate people to do, because we do, in fact, believe that our issue is more important than everybody else's. And we actually have science to back us up on that. Yeah. But I can't say that to somebody who has just lost their child to gun violence. I have to say that my issue is as important as yours.
Sure.
Not that my issue is more important than yours. And it's a subtle difference, but it matters tremendously in politics. And try to avoid getting into pissing contests on which issue is more important, which horrible thing is going to kill more Americans. We're not the merchants of death, you know?
Right. What was the next step on your path?
That was just one example. Probably the next major thing I had was this idea about the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge. See, what happened was Democratic candidates would come around the different caucuses of the party, and they would pander, for lack of a better way of putting it. So they'd show up at the Chicano Latino caucus, and they'd say, vote for me, se se puede, give me money. And then they'd go up to the Irish American caucus, and they'd say, Erin Gobra, vote for me, give me money. Apologies if I'm mangling the accent there. And then they'd show up to the Environmental Caucus and they'd say, vote for me, I hugged a tree yesterday, namaste, give me money.
Yeah.
And so there was pandering, and I felt that if they wanted to speak to my caucus, they had to pledge to be good actors in this way. And so I was able to extract what seemed to be a small promise to a lot of them, because a lot of them just wouldn't even think about taking fossil fuel money. And it became a movement. And it became so known and widespread and something that people actually wanted, that when candidates showed up, they knew that they would be signing the pledge. They brought their staffer to live stream them signing the pledge. And then they put it out on their Facebook pages. Here I am signing the pledge.
Yeah, you actually made it a plus for them.
Yes. What Kevin De Leon told me a long time ago was that all activists have power. It's just that I figured out that I have power. A lot of people don't know that they have power. And so what I will tell every activist is that you do in fact have power. Find your power and use it.
And for people that maybe at this particular time in their life, they just don't have time to be an activist, what would you tell them to do?
Find a little bit of time every day, whether that's simply signing a petition. Make sure that you are registered to vote. And please, if you can, vote by mail. And don't just vote in November. Vote in the primaries, because that's where we get the best people from the political party elected. It's not just showing up and reflexively voting for the party that I've always voted for my lifetime, the vote blue no matter who. It's show up during the primary. Do your research. Ask around locally. You will find that there is somebody or another willing to tell you which are the best climate candidates. My organization, Climate Hawks Vote, does very selective endorsing. We're picky about who we endorse. We don't reflexively endorse the Democrat just because they're running against a Republican who sucks. We look for climate hawks, and we actively endorse only people that we feel will be fierce on climate in some fashion or another. I found that I was good at being on the inside. There are people who don't want to be on the inside, who want to be on the outside. They would much rather be in the streets marching. And that is perfectly okay. This is a big movement and it takes everyone. And some people are more introverted. The person who stood up at her first meeting and said, vote for me. I brought the pie. And then there's going to be somebody who honestly would rather stand outside with a bullhorn yelling at Exxon to divest now, or yelling at the UC system to divest now. Exxon isn't going to be divesting anytime soon, sadly. No. When I say find your voice and find your power, I don't mean that everybody must follow my path. I mean that everybody should find their own voice and find their own power and use that.
I really enjoyed listening to your story, Aurel. I love the way you've taken it from just making that decision yourself from your own experience that you're going to get involved and see what difference you can make. And it's not that many years later on where you're now going to be a member of the DNC. You'll be taking up a seat there. And for all the change you've managed to make so far and the people you've motivated along the way, I'm sincerely hoping that this is just the beginning of a journey and it will keep going further and you'll get stronger and stronger as you do so. And bravo to you.
I hope so. Thank you. I appreciate hearing that. If I can add a plug that people should check out climatehawksvote.com, sign up for emails, get involved. We promise not to spam you too much.
Thank you so much, RL. One last question. What kind of pie did you take to that first meeting?
You know, I honestly don't remember. If it was the fall, it might have been an apple pie. If it was December, it might have been my famous Pecangelico pie, which is a normal pecan pie with just a little bit of Frangelico added. Oh, it's so good.
That sounds good.
If it was summertime, it might have been my super patriotic blackberry, blueberry, raspberry pie with a bit with a crumble on top. I got pies.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was a great conversation, and I wish you lots of luck in your new role. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of How to Stop Climate Change, please give us a review or share the show with a friend. If you'd like to support the show, please head over to howtostopclimatechange.com/support. All donations will go to cover expenses and help me pay my daughter, Keaton, for all the time she spends editing and producing the show. I couldn't do this without her.
Music for this episode was done by Avery Reedy and myself, Keaton Butler. Our theme music is by Juices.